Hello and welcome to Dialects. Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and our listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, and Radio Verulam in St Albans, and also to our listeners in Swindon. My name's Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman.
But we are part of different religious denominations, Muslim Sunnis, Orthodox Christians, Muslim Bektashis, Roman Catholics.
Yes, coming up in the programme, our reporter Anthea Page is back from a trip to Albania, and you'll be hearing a series of features on Albania over the next few weeks. We have a feature from Tony Gosling on the Wiltshire's chalk streams. He talks to Robin Broadbank, who is the president of the Wiltshire Trust for Nature Conservation.
We have Sarah Morris, who's our guest this week, and she'll be talking about the Great Swim. Malcolm Grieve continues on with Lady Stanhope's travels, and Hester arrives in Damascus. And we also have the What's On Guide with Addy.
It's my pleasure to introduce a Sarah Morris to the studio. Hello.
Hello.
Your interest is swimming. We've had an interest in swimming in previous weeks because we've had Susie Barr, who wrote a book called The Story of Swimming.
Mm-hmm.
We've interviewed her, and she's a member of the Henley's, what is it, outdoor?
It was Henley's Lake. Well, Henley's Lake. Swimming Club. We just call it the lake.
Okay, so like an outdoor swimming sort of thing.
Yeah, it was a quarry that was converted into a sort of a swimming space ages ago.
And you two are interested in outdoor swimming, the same?
Absolutely.
Same sport.
There are a lot of us about. We're a bit crazy.
Tell me a little bit about Henley's Lake then. How did you first hear about this place? I've never heard of it.
Oh, gosh, I can't remember. It's about 15 years ago, and it wasn't as well known then as it is now. And in those days, you had to get people to agree that you could join. It was like that.
Okay, a little bit of a nod and a wink, and, you know, are they suitable for our clan?
Yes, they didn't, you know, it was, selective. But it's just something that I personally have always, for me, I have to find somewhere to swim, and swimming in the outdoors is such a great experience. There must be loads and loads of people who know that and enjoy that. And if you're living in a city, to find somewhere where you can swim outdoors with that kind of environment, you know, you can look up at the sky and, you know, you're swimming along and there's the duck swimming along beside you. It's just an absolute joy. It's a real oasis in every sense of the word.
Is it not absolutely freezing?
It's on the cool side if you're not into... You do get used to it. You do get used to it. And you can wear a rash vest or a special swimmer's wetsuit if you need to. But actually, on a really hot day, you don't need to. It gets up to about 21 degrees.
Okay.
Which some people might find cool.
A little bit below body temperature, but it's still
pretty good. But actually, it's really, really refreshing.
Yeah.
It's really, really invigorating.
Do you get kind of inured to the cold after a few trips? You know, just to sort of not... notice it, or do you sort of notice it but you don't mind as much as you used to?
I think you know, I mean, for me, 15 degrees centigrade, that's below that, and I want to wear a wetsuit.
Okay. Alice, when did you first try outdoor swimming? I mean, were you always interested in swimming when you were a kid, or was this sort of something you tried?
Recently, you know, I found a picture of myself as a toddler with one of those funny curly swimsuits, and I don't know how it happened, who took my photograph with my father, and I'm looking at his face and smiling, and so I think I was sort of encouraged to be in the water as a very small child, and so my life has always been around being in the pool or being in the sea.
Okay.
So it's just one of those things that it's almost, you know, when I get to a new town, where's the bakery? Where's the swimming pool?
Right, okay.
So that's just part of...
Do you have kids yourself?
Uh-huh.
Do you sort of bully them into getting in the Henley's Lake? Go on in yet.
Well, my daughter swims there. Yeah, she's a member there as well. She's taken it up. And we do. We do enjoy it very much. Well, yes.
Okay.
But I don't force them to, you know, force them to swim if they don't want to.
What did you make of David Walliams' possibly lethal health risk in swimming up the Thames? Did you observe his...
But see, we used to jump in the river in the Thames at Windsor. So I used to live around there when I was a kid. So I hadn't realised just how risky it was in terms of all those germs. It just seems a shame, because I thought the Thames was a lot cleaner than it is. But what do I know?
Well, it wasn't very much an emphasis on health and safety when it came to kids' pursuits in decades past.
No.
Sorry.
No, that's true.
And there'd be lots of adults going, no, no.
I know. And when I was a young child, the risk of polio was a real major factor, and swimming in rivers and streams. But that's how people learnt to swim. And I certainly used to swim in a stream when I was a kid, when I first came to England. But there was a mill stream in the village near where I lived, and we would go there. And, you know, there was cows grazing in the meadow, and there was the stream. We would swim. It was great swimming in fresh water if you couldn't get down to the sea.
Moving things a little further north, you heard about an event going on up in Lake Windermere, is it?
Yeah, Lake Windermere in the Lake District.
The Great North Swim.
That's right, part of the British Gas Great Swim Series.
Okay, so there are some of these all around the country going on?
Yeah, British Gas appear to sort of sponsor swimming events, and they run a series of swims in locations like Lake Windermere. They also do in the London Docks, for example. There's another one in Scotland. I can't remember where the other one is, but they do a series of them. And they're quite well known. There's a Facebook site for it and so on. You know, it's very, very popular.
How big a swim are you talking about?
Yeah, well, if for under 12s and for beginners, you do half a mile. For the likes of me, it's a mile. And then if you really have got the speed and the endurance, you can do 2 miles, which is about 3 kilometres.
Wow, okay, and you went for the one.
Thank you, that was enough for me. I mean, that was a challenge because I had no idea that I could do that. And I was heading for a big O birthday last year, and I just thought it would be interesting to do something with a bit of a physical challenge.
Yeah.
And then when my friend lives in Kendal said, oh, come on, come and visit me and come and do the swim at the same time. And I thought, well, okay, this is going to give me a challenge. And I really hadn't realised that I could swim that distance.
Okay. Do you have to sort of slap on the goose fat before you get in, you know, slap it all over?
No, but you do have to wear, they insist if you're going to do the Great North Swim, they insist that you wear a wetsuit. And it's not the sort of wetsuit that you do scuba diving in. It's the sort of triathlon thing. That was the worst bit of it all, actually.
Is that not like a bit irritating or frustrating if you don't really wear that when you're practicing swimming and you swim outdoors anyway?
Well, you know, the thing is that if you're going to do open water swimming regularly and you've ended up spending some money on a wetsuit, you end up swimming more. That's what I've found, is that you want to make use of having your wetsuit.
So, okay, so you got used to it before.
You do need to get used to it. It's no good just going in the first time trying to do something like that and you haven't practiced wearing the wetsuit, yes. But it's getting it on is really quite a challenge.
So, I mean, when you were practicing this, how much of that was sort of a psychological thing when you're trying to think, you know, normally when you're just swimming in your own time for leisure, obviously there's no particular distance or whatever, you can stop when you like. So, I mean, how did you sort of have to think about psychologically about swimming for a mile, or is it just literally just sort of head down, just blast your way through it?
Well, I think this particular event, what I think is good about this event is that there isn't a huge pressure to do it in any particular time. And it took me 55 minutes to do a mile, which, believe me, is very slow. The elite swimmers were doing it in 20 minutes, 18 minutes.
Okay, so how we picture the scene then? What was it like when you arrived? How many, you know, people were there?
Oh, well, I mean, we arrived on the ferry, so we'd actually driven to another part of Lake Windermere. Lake Windermere is really big, and we got on the ferry. So as we were arriving at this, because it goes on all weekend, there's just hundreds and hundreds of people taking part. You know, every hour or so, there's 300 people getting
in
the
water. All at once, then?
No, they do it in waves.
Well, that's visible, I suppose.
And it's a bit like, sort of, I suppose, when people do a marathon or something like that. You know, you have a warm up at the beginning, and but we saw the boys in the water, so we could see where we would be swimming. And I looked at it and thought, oh yes, you know, you sort
any
of
any second thoughts?
Well, you do. Yeah. You think, what have I let myself in for? And there's that sort of sense of really, really wanting to do it. And that awful feeling of, well, what if I don't, you know?
And how were you feeling when you actually walked into the water?
Absolutely fine, because, you know, I'd gone through all this sort of, you know, agony of it, and we were late. We had to run from getting off the ferry to the site, so we really didn't have time to think about it. And getting this blooming wetsuit on was really, I was still putting it on when we were at the starting line. The people that had been there for had already had a bit of a dip in the water, so they'd we were late, and everyone was doing their warm up, and we were late, and it was like, ooh! And just as we were getting in, I had the sense to say to the woman, what's the water temperature? And she said 16.1 degrees. I thought, ah, that's fine.
And do you warm up as you're going along, or do you feel the cold more?
I think you're just so in the moment with it.
Yeah.
And there's loads of people there. And
do you get sort of like a marathon runner's high when you're swimming?
I think you have to sort of really be calm in the water, really, really calm. And I think it's that sense of you go from one boy to the next, and you just have to aim for the next boy and just keep going. And I think as soon as I got in the water, I thought, I can do this. And I was high when I got out, for sure.
Yeah. So when is this taking place?
It's usually around the summertime, so around the sort of June, July time, the whole series. The Great North Swim is taking place in June.
And, you know, do people have enough time to train up for this if they're not, you know, really swimmers regularly, if they're starting now?
Oh, Oh, they should do. Yeah, they should do. Yes, I would say, I mean, I did hear that people were taking part in the Great North Swim who'd never been in open water before, which I think is very, very brave. But some people do it.
Possibly foolish, by the sounds of it.
Well, you know, I'm not going to say anything about that. But there are safety boats so that you
just
know,
to pick people, you up.
Yeah.
Okay. And briefly to wrap up, tell me a bit about more Henley's Lake. How can people get involved in that if they want to?
Well, unfortunately, there's a very, very long waiting list. So if you want to join, you just have to put your name. Definitely worth if you're keen.
Yeah. Applying. And they're on the internet.
Absolutely, there's a website, and if you can just join to swim during the week, if you don't mind, if you're retired or something, you can swim during the day.
Yeah.
But the weekends are usually very popular, obviously, with people who are working.
Well, Sarah Morris, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Now for a song from Zudo Lazoha, who lives in Ulcind in Montenegro, just north of Albania. This song is from his CD, but he never sells his music. He gives his CDs out to all of his friends. It's very nice. This song is called Muke Porta El Kalase, and I'm very, very sorry for the pronunciation.
Oh.
continuing on with our Albanian theme now, our next feature is an interview with the Culture Minister of Albania, no less, followed by an interview with the Director of the Museum of Art in Tirana.
But first, before that, let's hear about the background of Albanian history. Rather a broad topic, but we thought it was worthy of inclusion, just to kind of give you a roundup in a relatively short way about a country which most people know nothing. Albania was liberated from the yoke of 400 years of Ottoman rule in 1912. After the First World War, during which Albania was a succession of fragmented autonomous statelets, the country emerged as an independent state under the self-proclaimed King Zog. In April 1939, Mussolini invaded Albania and the king fled into exile with his family. When Italy surrendered in 1943, the country was then occupied by Germany. Britain gave great support to the partisan movement, supplying them with weapons, clothes and ammunition. In 1943, with air support from the RAF, the battle for the liberation of Tirana, the capital, began and lasted 19 days, and Germans were finally driven out. A communist regime then took over a devastated country, and all farms were turned into collectives in 1946. Enver Hoxha, which is a name you might recognise, which I did, I didn't really know who he was, he had formed the Communist Party and he ruled the country from 1945 to 1985 as a dictator.
In the late 1950s, when Albania began to industrialise itself, relations between the USSR and China deteriorated. Albania chose to follow the Chinese communism, and from 1960 to 1967, Albania followed a brutal Chinese-style cultural revolution. Albania banned the practice of religion and declared itself the world's first atheist state. Priests, Muslims and clerics were shot or imprisoned, and mosques and churches were demolished or converted into warehouses. The country was closed to the outside world. The land borders were sealed with a 26-metre high electrified barbed wire fence, and anyone who tried to escape, whether by land or sea, was shot. People who opposed the regime were sent to prison and labour camps, which sprung up all over the country. Albania withdrew from the Warsaw Pact in 1968 and began a programme of self-reliant defence policy. Some 70,000 concrete bunkers, which still litter the country today, were built to withstand foreign invasion. During this time, the Communist Party drained the malaria swamps, raised the literacy level and built hydroelectric plants and laid down railway tracks. When Zoxha died in 1985, the country fell into apathy, resulting in serious food shortages. And after student demonstrations, which were held in 1990, the government allowed the country to have opposition parties. In March 1992, elections ended 47 years of communist rule. And since 2002, the country has found itself in an economic revival, although the corruption still remains and is one of the country's most severe stumbling blocks.
So, now that we've heard the history of Albania in the past 100 years, and now on to our first interview with Culture Minister of Albania, followed by an interview with the Director of the Museum of Art in Tirana. And the music is from southern Albania, and it's called The Dirge of Permit.
My name is Aldo Bunci. I am the Minister of Culture, yes.
Can you tell us about the exhibition and why you're here today at the museum?
This is a jubilee. It's 100 years of independence. We announced last year an international competition. There were 61 artists, Albanian and international, German, Italian, Spanish, Mexican, which took part in this competition. There was an international jury, a jury composed by 9 members. The jury has selected the best 5 pieces. The jury has voted. There is a ranking of these 5 pieces of art, but we didn't make it public, not because we don't want to influence the public decision. We want to leave it to them. We will have 10 days open for the public. They could come here and vote directly or online. Via internet, they could participate and select the monument that they think best represents 100 years of independence. At the end of these 10 days, the judgment of the jury and the public's feedback will be presented to the government, the State Council, set up for the organization of 100 years of independence. And at the end, there will be a final decision based on this 2 judgments, the international jury and the feedback by the citizens.
So where will this statue stand when it's finished?
In Tirana there are 2 or 3 public spaces, but we have not decided that yet. That will be a final decision by the National Council, the winning author and the municipality of Tirana. At the end, once we will have a winner together, the municipality of Tirana and the winning author will decide among two or three public spaces which will be offered for this monument.
So as minister, is it your job to promote Albanian art in Europe?
Yes, that is part of the functions which I should perform. This is a country with a unique history. We can say that we are Europe's last secret. We are in the heart of Europe, a 1 hour flight from Rome, from Vienna. But because of imposed self-isolation during communism, this country has remained a secret in the heart of Europe. Now this secret is open. The country is being visited by tourists. The numbers have increased, even though we have started with very low numbers. There is a positive coverage by international media. The British newspapers and media in particular has had a very positive coverage of the touristic assets, the touristic potential of this country, the mountains. This year there were articles in The Guardian, if I'm not mistaken, about the Northern Alps, the cursed mountains. There's been coverage of Albanian Riviera. So we need to promote our country. And art and culture is a way to do that, to associate the country's image with the positive developments. I think Albania has a lot to offer. It has a stunning coast with sandy beaches. It's unique in the Adriatic and Ionian Sea in the Eastern Adriatic. From Slovenia down to Greece, you will not find sandy beaches stretching for 200 kilometers. The Southern Riviera, it's rocky and petty, and it's New York Times called it last year a frugal paradise. You can move from the coastal areas in the heart of the Alps, which are like a Swiss landscape. Albanian Alps are beautiful, but they are not wild beauties. They have people in it, villages and people living. And Albania is very rich in cultural heritage. From prehistoric times, Neolithic era, antiquity, we have Illyrian, our predecessors, Roman, Hellenic. We have Byzantine, Ottoman. Albania is very rich in spiritual heritage. We belong to different religious denominations. We are unique in the religious harmony. We are Albanians, have a strong ethnic identity, but we are part of different religious denominations, Muslim Sunnis, Orthodox Christians, Muslim Bektashis, Roman Catholics. The country, I think, has a lot to offer to tourists.
Of art. I've come to meet the director of the museum. Hello.
My name is Rubens Shima, and I am the director of the National Art Gallery in Tirana, Albania.
How is art in Albania? Are you looking to expand it into the European scene?
The question is in two parts. First, how is art in Albania? We have a particular art history here. The secular painting in Albania starts in the end of 19th century. We are still in the time where Albanians were not a country, but only an entity into the Ottoman Empire. And then, in 1912, we have the independence of the Albania. And also, we have the art history that start from this time, or we have started from Byzantium, post-Byzantium, and then secular painting. All art in Albania, its history is 120 years old. Let's say it is divided in two main periods, before the war and then during the social realism, during the communism that we call the art of social realism. Of course, Albania, for long and strong isolation, it reflects this isolation also in art. in the structure of Albanian art miss many important periods. I'm speaking for those earliest tendencies of modernism that were present in the Europe. In Albania, we don't have it, like Impressionism, Futurism, Cubism, Surrealism, Dadaism, and so on. Because here, for 50 years, the social realism art always has been propaganda for the communists. Now, the second period, I consider it the second period after the big political change of 90s, it is a different story. There are a lot of information, literature also coming mostly from the West. The Albanians now are familiar with different tendencies of movement in world art, European art. And there is a young artist generation who are successfully exhibit here in the museum, in the National Gallery, but also in other local galleries here. But also they are exhibiting successfully in different European countries.
Which leads to the second part of my question. Yeah. How do you envisage Albania entering into the European art scene?
I think that our particular history, it is quite interesting to be represented for the foreign audience in Europe or in the world. I think that our past is a very interesting material to work with. Also, Albanian artists mostly nowadays work with our past and repropose this past in a global context. Those are some of the concepts of different exhibitions that we organize out of Albania, but also in Albania. And this finds it with a lot of interest for foreign audiences to see a different country, to see a country which has been for such a long time under isolation. And what is a risk in this process is that always they prefer to see Albania always with an exotic eye. This is a risk or a permanent risk that Albanian art is exposed to.
Have you made any links with European art galleries?
We organize different exhibitions here. We also organize interesting exhibition in different museums in Europe, mostly in Italy, also in Beijing, in China. But in this summer, would have a very interesting exhibition of British artists, which is the collection of the British Council. Important artists come from the movement of young British artist movement, like Sarah Lucas, Damien Hirst, also will have some beautiful painting for Peter Doig, and it will be a very interesting exhibition, and those exhibitions myself and Albanians here consider as a very important exhibition because they are a possibility to understand and to know those artists and also different culture.
So do you have a website if people are interested in the exhibition that's coming up?
Yes, we have a website. GKA Pikalda, I'm saying in Albanian, but I'll give it to you. So, GKL@AL.AL.
Thank you very much to Anthea Page. Once again, forgive our pronunciation if we've got any of that wrong. She was reporting from the emerging country of Albania. Well, we go from Albania to things closer to home. How come there is a hosepipe ban whilst rivers are bursting their banks and at the same time we have flood warnings? To find out, we go back in time once again to look at Wiltshire's chalk streams. Back in the early 1990s, Dialect's Tony Gosling met up with the president of the Wiltshire Trust for Nature Conservation on Wiltshire's River Wyly indeed. His name was Robin Broadbank, and some of the things that he said struck us as worthy of repeating. Robin explains how modern privatised water companies suck water out of the natural aquifers under the ground, sometimes making streams and rivers disappear entirely.
Well, here we are on the bridge over the main stream of the River Wyly, which you can see looks quite different, the river, to what we've just been looking at on the mill stream over there. Now, there's far less water in here, and therefore there's far slower current. We haven't got the depth we had over there. It's completely devoid of that lovely river weed we looked at, which is called water buttercup. The bottom is covered with a sort of brown algae slime stuff, which is called blanket weed, which clings to the stones.
Why is the lack of the green weed? Because, of course, it's the same water. It's just been divided up to go along the two different streams.
That's quite right. I think the reason for that is that the current is slow here. That green weed thrives in fast current. If we went down and looked where the ripple is there, we'd probably find the green weed growing. Here, you haven't got the current to encourage the weed to grow.
Now, you did mention that you were going to try and find some trout for me.
Yes, I'll try and find you a trout. There's one or two other things I'd like to comment about in this stream. I mentioned the awful brown, slimy stuff that clings to the stones. Well, that's a blanket weed, and it discourages the growth of the green weed as well as the lack of flow. The fact the water is growing much more slowly and hasn't got the fast ripple you see down there means that there is less oxygen in it too. And without the oxygen content, a lot of the wildlife doesn't thrive.
But it really doesn't look quite so healthy as the other one.
No, it doesn't. It looks dead sick, I'd say. Dead sick for all those reasons. That there isn't enough water in it. We won't talk about yet why there isn't enough water in it. Let's try and find a fish. Yes, here we are. We're standing by the river here. Now, there's quite a nice trout lying near the bank here. You see him there, turned on his side a bit, moving downstream. About 3/4 of a pound, I think. Quite a nice fish.
Now, as we were walking up here, we were talking about the level of the river. What's it like at the moment?
The river, it's come up, as I said, at the other stream. It's come up by about a foot in the last 10 days due to the rain. And the flow is quicker than it has been. If we could get it up another foot, which we can only do by more rain, then you'll find the current will increase sufficiently to clean the bottom and get rid of all that awful brown, slimy stuff.
In fact, it looks like it could probably, the banks could quite easily take another couple of feet.
Oh, yes, easily. If you'd come here a month ago, you'd found this was about 18 inches lower and there had been a great area of foreshore showing along the edge over there. And we were right down to a summer level in March, which of course is disastrous. Over too long a period, 3 years, we've had very poor rainfall in the winter.
And how much of a problem is the well-known abstraction? You know, the water companies obviously take a certain amount of water out themselves, don't they?
Yes, they do.
For public use.
They've got two large boreholes up 3 miles upstream at Codford and Chittern, where they have permission to extract large quantities of water for the public under licence, and they've had that for 20 years. What worries people about that is that the rainfall is not falling, therefore the water table is dropping, but they're pumping all the time from a smaller and smaller groundwater reservoir. And we feel a bit, wildlife conservation people and the fishing people, that too much water is being abstracted, considering the conditions of the river, which depend on the rain which hasn't been falling. This is our anxiety, but what the water people are doing is perfectly legal. They have to supply the public, as you said, the water consumption is going up all the time, more demands on it, more houses.
Is there any way that they can adjust the amount of water they're taking out to the rainfall? So, for instance, if the, like you said, it goes down 18 inches below the current level, we can say to the water companies, well, hang on a minute, maybe you should be taking a little less out.
Yes, they are sensitive to this. And in fact, there is what the river authority call a flow gauge in the river, just above where the boreholes are. And the water company is obliged to ensure that there is a certain level of flow at that point. And if it falls below it, then their abstraction must be reduced.
But generally, I think the Wylie looks like a healthy river.
Well, it's much better than it was, is all I can say standing here. There's more water in it than there has been for a long time at this moment. And it's very nice to see. I just hope this part of it is going to get the look of what we saw first of all in the mill stream. And it can only do that if we can keep up this flow of water to get it healthy.
At this part of the river, we've got a very good example of the water meadows. Now, I know originally, up until the war, those were used for grazing sheep by use of irrigation channels.
That's right. The irrigation channels brought the water onto the land to get the grass growing. That system collapsed. It got too expensive. And nitrogen fertilisers did the job anyway, if you wanted to put them on. But the point I'd like to make particularly is that the effect of that not only got the grass growing, but it created a sponge underground of water, which remained in the land and could be used when there wasn't enough rain, there was a bit of a drought. It seeped back into the rivers. It kept the levels up. Now, what with lack of rain in the winter, as I mentioned, perhaps too much abstraction, and the loss of that sponge, you've got three good reasons why the water table has collapsed. And because the water table collapsed, the river depends on springs, the springs aren't flowing, and therefore you have too little water. It happens to look rather good today because we've had enough rain recently. But you come back here in 10 days without rain and you'll find that river's gone right down by a foot. The sponge is gone.
That was Robin Broadbank and Dialect's Tony Gosling on the banks of the River Wyly in Wiltshire, discussing water privatisation and how it has also meant much more secrecy about what these businesses are doing to our water tables. And it was first broadcast on BBC Wiltshire Sound back in 1993.
Next up, we have another instalment of Lady Hester Stanhope, Queen of the Desert, famous socialite and adventurer, read by Malcolm Grieve.
Lady Hester Stanhope, Queen of the Desert. As soon as they descended from the mountains, they were hit by the appalling summer heat, and Michael started arguing bitterly with Marion once again. It was accepted that Michael had a short temper, but tension between the two men rapidly reached such a point that Marion wrote secretly to his sister in England, saying that he had decided it best to leave. His indignation at how Michael was treating him led him to make some scathing remarks that probably had a lot of truth in them. Indulged from his infancy by the fondness of a weak father, who at an early age let him loose on the world with the command of a large fortune, he fumed. He has been flattered and caressed until the slightest opposition to his will makes him sulky and churlish. Marion was not an unkind man. Indeed, he was always ready to believe the best of anyone. He must have received enormous and sustained provocation to criticise Michael so strongly. His decision to leave was a desperate move, for he still idolised Lady Hester and loved his life with her. He told Hester of his plan, and at first she reluctantly agreed it might be best if he left. But then she changed her mind. Marion was an ideal travelling companion, dependable, brave and loyal, and she had no wish to lose him. She still loved Michael dearly, but was no longer blind to his many faults, and could see that he was making Marion's life a misery. Michael had been wanting to go to Aleppo for some time, while Hester herself favoured going to Damascus, so she suggested the party split for a few weeks. Michael would go to Aleppo accompanied by Monsieur Bertrand, his dragoman, whilst she and Marion would travel to Damascus. There she would have the opportunity to investigate the possibilities of a journey to the deserted city of Palmyra. And whilst Marion and Michael were apart, tensions between the two men would have time to ease, and perhaps all would be well. Another reason for them to split up for a while was that Michael was often overly solicitous with her, and if he were away for a while, it would enable her to make a dramatic entrance into the city of Damascus. She had been in touch with the newly appointed Pasha there, who had courteously invited her to his city, but he had made the mistake of telling her that she must wear a veil when in public. Not only was Damascus one of the most rigorously Muslim of cities, but there had been some recent unrest. Christians were despised throughout the Levant, but perhaps nowhere as much as in Damascus. There they were required to live in a particularly unsalubrious part of town, and were scarcely allowed to enter the Muslim areas. If they made themselves conspicuous in any way, even by wearing a jaunty turban, or yellow slippers, for example, they ran the risk of being physically attacked. Riding a horse was also forbidden. To most European women, it might have seemed a prudent step, at least to wear a veil. Of course, she refused. Having seen Michael and Monsieur Bertrand off to Aleppo, she set off for Damascus. With a terrified Marion riding behind her, she approached the city at mid-afternoon. Inside, the streets were packed with people. With either great courage or great foolhardiness, she rode in through the gates, in her most splendid clothes, unveiled and with her head high. It worked. The crowds fell silent and let her pass unscathed. Lady Hester had become a law unto herself. A queen in Damascus. The city of Damascus is the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world, and was known to both Franks and Muslims alike as the Pearl of the Desert. It has always been a place of immense religious and strategic importance. As a direct result, it has been one of the most beleaguered cities in the country that has suffered invasion and conquest since it was first inhabited. Unlike some of the more mundane cities of Syria, Damascus has a rich history of beliefs and legends that have woven themselves into the very fabric of the city. One of these strands relates how God created Adam from the clay of the river Berada, on which Damascus stands. Another belief that has survived the centuries is that the painted Virgin of Saidnaya weeps real tears. The tomb, which purports to be that of John the Baptist, is in Damascus, though various other places also claim that honour. And even more equivocally, there is the tomb of Abel, 20 feet long, and so narrow as to be quite out of human proportion. Almost hidden amongst these uncertainties are a few marvellous nuggets. There is a road running through the town, which is called Straight, and on its dusty, undeviating length is indubitably the site of St. Paul's baptism. Many historical facts and legends about the city have survived the centuries. Much of the physical fabric of the ancient city has also withstood the passage of time. Now, though, the old narrow lanes are overshadowed by ugly concrete tenement blocks that make it hard to remember that Damascus is meant to have been built on the site of the Garden of Eden. The ancient and famous Great Umayyad Mosque still stands, however, and walking within the profound tranquility of its cloistered walls, it is possible to imagine a time when all around there was an oasis of peace and beauty. There is a mosaic on the walls of the mosque that seems to echo the legend of the Garden of Eden. Because unlike most mosaic work, this one is representational and depicts exquisite pastoral scenes from some unknown halcyon time. The site of the mosque has been sacred for 3,000 years, and if its story were ever to be told, it would reflect the whole history of Damascus. Not only Muslims, but Aramaeans, Greeks, Romans and Christians have worshipped their gods there. It is a peaceful place.
Thanks to Malcolm Grieve there for reading another part of Lady Hester Stanhope, Queen of the Desert by Virginia Childs.
Time for some poetry, and I'd like to introduce Rosemary Dunn. Hello.
Hello there.
Any particular themes or topics that are springing to mind lately? What have you got for us today?
Okay, well, the poem that I'm going to be reading today is that situation that you can find yourself in when you bump into an old girlfriend or an old boyfriend. So this is called Outside the Arnolfini. Your smile is what I've remembered most over the years. It competes with the sunlight and the fresh smell of your body, which once whispered promises on hot summer nights. As I watch you talk, freckles pop out on your forehead, while the sun angles on our words, which in turn are carried downriver to the sea. Do you remember that day? When we set off in your small dinghy on the docks, and how you said you had to tip me in so's I could be a real sailor, and how later we kissed and lapped at droplets of water mingled with our sweat. I can easily recall shared moments if I close my eyes. It would be so easy to reach out and touch you, reclaim you for myself, but I don't. Instead, I ask, how are the kids? and we part on a promise to ring. We must meet, catch up, even though we both know we won't. Still, I smile as I walk off again, happy in the knowledge that I was 21 again. Then, when we met by chance.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was a short one.
Yeah, well, it was short. I mean, you've got time for another one.
Oh, thank you very much. Okay. Well, I'll do this poem, which is, we were talking about whether or not you do cover versions of poems.
Yeah.
And I foolishly said, no, of course you can't. And then we went on to discuss many people who have done cover versions. And this poem is, it's not a cover version of another poem, but it's a kind of rewriting or reimagining of a fairy tale. It's taking a fairy tale and using that. So this is called Rapunzel. So they kept me in my tower at the top of those stairs, Sleeping Beauty, Briar Rose, Rat-clove chains. I was pretty in waiting, my face dark with cinders and with sugar cane. If I was lucky, they'd let me have a Lady of Shalott mirror mirror on the wall for me to peer and check that I could be the fairest of them all. If only I could get clean, blonde. If only I could be good, face as white as snow pitched on a glass coffin. If only I wasn't Joe with a temper so fierce it burnt out dear Mama and killed sweet sister Beth. Then I could let that old wizened man into my cell, and he'd give me the power to spin my hair into gold, plait it as the strongest, silkiest rope to fashion my escape. Rumpelstiltskin, thrice said, was how I surprised that incubus sat upon my chest. I named his horrible demon demands, named him and nailed him, so that with a puff of smoke he disappeared. And flames devoured the briars which spun their prickly falsehoods around my tower, as I cut off the long hank of my just-for-him hair with golden shears, so that no more would he climb, prick my finger, nor ravish me awake. Instead, my howls, which once filled my madwoman's attic with despair, announced the birth of my daughter. We hold hands and jump.
Rosemary Dunn, thank you very much. Do you have any future public engagements coming up at all?
Well, I do, actually. Thank you for asking. I'm going to be performing at the Hay on Wye Fringe Festival called How the Light Gets In. And that's during the Hay on Wye Festival week, bank holiday weekend. And I'm going to be performing on the 4th of June at 12 o'clock, I think it is, with a show. I'm doing an hour-long show with poetry, audience participation, and a bit of bad ukulele playing.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We haven't got any Jeff Sparks, I'm afraid, this week, but he's written us a What's On Guide, and Addie Olighton has very kindly volunteered to read it for us. So over to you for the What's On Guide, Addie.
Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialert. Starting with 11th May, Jelly Records Boys Fest fundraising concert will feature a solo acoustic set from John E. Fistic and also performances by Bashir and African Blues Connection at Hall 2 in Causton Hall, Causton Street, Bristol. Tickets are £5 each and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 11th May, the ZZ Top tribute group, the ZZ Tops, will be performing at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present Daniel O'Donnell. His career started in 1983 and to date he has released over 40 albums, either studio or compilation. And also he has released numerous singles. This is from the album On to the Next Time, which was released in 2006, and it's the track Beyond the Rainbow's End.
I have gone from sight, but I am waiting. waiting just beyond the rainbow's end. I'm happy in this place that I have come to, because I'm here with my forever friend. Now all your thoughts of me, let them be joyful, of things we've done and happy times we've shared. So don't be sad, dear ones, because I've left you. Please laugh and talk of me as if I'm there. Just look up in the sky, I am the sunshine. I'm the mist that rises on a summer's morn. I'm the gentle breeze that cools the autumn evening, when the birds sing in the trees, I am their song. This journey I have made, one day you'll make it. You too will be with my forever friend. It's then once more that we will be together. I'll meet you just beyond the rainbow's end. It's then once more that we will be together. I'll meet you just beyond the rainbow's end. Yes, I'm waiting just beyond the rainbow's end.
That was Daniel O'Donnell with Beyond the Rainbow's End from the album Until the Next Time. For more information, you can check out www.danieloDonnell.org. Into Saturday, 12th May, Happy Mondays will be performing with support from Inspiral Carpets at the O2 Academy in Bristol Street, Birmingham. Tickets are £35 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 13th May, the Tender Trap will include Joanne Swan, Ruth Armand and Tammy Payne will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and the gig starts 9 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care. Goodbye.
Many thanks, Addy. That's all from Dialect this week. You heard a feature about the current situation in Syria from Anthea Page, as well as a report from her recent trip to Albania. You can hear more on that next week. We also had Tony Gosling, who talked to Robin Broadbank, president of the Wiltshire Trust for Nature Conservation, about the effects of the privatisation of water companies. We had Malcolm Grieve reading more from Lady Stanhope's Travels in the Middle East by Virginia Childs, and we had Rosemary Dunn reading us some poetry.
Thank you to Jeff Sparks for writing us the What Song Guide and providing us with the Song of the Week. We hope he's all right and that he'll be back soon. And thank you very much to Addy O'Lighton for reading that out for us. That's all for us this week. It's goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman.
And myself, Michaela Dennis.
The engineer was Michael Noyce and the producer was Anthea Page. Thank you very much and I'll see you next week.
But nowhere's more devoted. but I love Albania back. On the hillside, in the valleys, in the forests, on the lakes, all Albania cries out Norman, hey, you got what it takes. As I wander down this fine Albanian street, the crowd's affection sweeps me off my feet. I've made my name in many places, a thousand falls, a thousand faces, but nowhere's more devoted than Albania, 'cause they've got Norman mania. I may be way off track, but I love Albania back.
And when the leaders saw his films, they told the nation, wise up to Norman wisdom, proletarian salvation. Don't pan him, don't can him, don't criticize or ban him. His struggle with the boss will be the workers' inspiration.
I love Albania back.